You may be right.
You may be right, Floyd, but it's good morning, Tampa Bay. And I'm Augie, and Floyd Winters is having a little trouble being heard, and we all want to be heard, don't we?
No, we've got the volume on. They had the buttons turned off. I come in here, and it's a musical chairs game of buttons and what's happening controls.
Buttons and
we're
whistles.
Back.
Yeah, we've got
that. Welcome to the Morning Edge. I'm Floyd J. Winters, and here is Augie, and here's our volume.
Okay, good morning, Tampa Bay. Well, the New York Times, if you read the newspapers, New York Times being the lead newspaper in the country, it's a prison guard beat up by a beat-up squad is blamed in death, that they normally do this to silence people about the behavior. This is the same prison that the two guys escaped from. I'll give you the name of the prison here in a second. Anyway, Fishkill Correction Facility. Sam Harrell, an inmate with a history of erratic behavior linked to bipolar, packed his bags and announced he was going to go home. Unfortunately for him, that was basically his last words, and several witnesses have now testified after months of discussion. This happened clear back in April 21 in Building 21 at the Fishkill facility. Anyway, you've got that, and you've got, these are New York Times headlines, a prison guard beat-up squad blamed in death. In other words, they have a routine of beating people up, and sometimes death becomes the outcome. And death by homicide provoked no interest in jailing any of the jailers. Then you have, in one man's refusal to eat, puts Israel against the ropes as well. So the situation is one that is prevailing. Circumstances where people are persecuted and the persecutors pay no price. Anyway, so we're going to have our guest in here shortly, and we'll be talking about some of these headlines, the upstart rating giants for staff for Silicon Valley. This is another headline. That's where people are coming and taking business away from Silicon Valley. Lots of changes on the horizon. And do we have our guest?
Our guest is live on the line. Bill, welcome to the Morning Edge.
This is William.
Thank you. It's good
morning,
to be back.
Morning, Bill. You've been on here before, and it's good to talk to you. You're on the cusp of a real interesting time for this country with the arrival in September, I believe, of the Pope. Pope Francis is becoming extremely popular in the country. And Bill, you have a reputation of your own. You're from Sacramento now. You work out there in the Diocese of Sacramento. Do you want to talk a little bit about you're an author. You've written books, and we've talked before about this Pope Francis and all the issues with the church. So what are the issues of social justice still on his horizon?
Oh, more than ever. I work at the, I'm a little off on the geography, though. I work at the Diocese of Monterey.
Oh, where did I get Sacramento? That's the capital of California.
Right, right.
Yeah, sorry
I
about
work
that.
In Monterey, which, mm-hmm. of course, is where the Carmel Mission is, where Junipero Serra is buried. And so that's why We've been getting particularly involved.
Who is buried there?
Junipero Serra, who is going to be canonized when the Pope comes.
Oh, he's going to get the canonization or proposal for canonization. Serra, S-E-R-R-A?
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Bill.
But I also teach theology at Santa Clara University.
Mm-hmm. So it's a university there. So you've got a lot on your plate. And when the Pope comes, are you going to greet him? Are you going to go there and be there?
I'll be part of hundreds of thousands, I'm sure, that will be greeting him. I think it's important for people to remember on this trip that he's making, it's actually a trip first to Cuba. And he'll spend a couple of days there before he comes to the United States. But I'm sure that he sees this trip as all of one piece. And so I think the relationship between the United States and Cuba is going to be on his mind. But certainly all of the social justice issues of the church will be paramount for him while he's here.
Bill, that's an interesting point. Social justice for the church. For the first time, I'm hearing the far right hating the Catholic Church, or at least the leader of the Catholic Church, because he believes in social justice. That is, he believes in working to help people who may be below the minimum wage, who have poverty. He believes in trying to save the environment. He believes in such radical things as helping thy brother. And this is an interesting thing I'm hearing from the Fox News Network, people condemning this new radical Pope. What do you think about that, Bill?
Well, for those of us who have been at this for a while, you have to pardon me if I laugh. I mean, social justice teaching of the Catholic Church is centuries old, and in its modern form, we could trace it back to Pope Leo XIII in the 1800s. So while it might be new for some folks, it certainly isn't from what we're hearing. And Pope Francis is really not, he hasn't, I think the one thing he has added to this corpus of work has been his latest encyclical Laudato Si, which is on the environment. But this has been a constant tradition of the Catholic Church, and in particular over the last 120 years.
So the Pope's interest in preserving God's creation, the environment, and Fox News Network is just really upset about such an idea to preserve God's creation.
It's been interesting to observe their reaction and the reaction of others. Under previous papacies, of course, everything the Pope said was to be done with great attention to detail, and now all of a sudden we're being told that we don't have to pay attention to certain things the Pope says. So it's kind of out of both sides of their mouth a little bit.
Isn't the problem the issue of liberation theology that kind of fell under the axe of Pope John Paul II and was somewhat reinforced under his follower Benedict, who's retired now? I mean, that issue and what happened to Central and South America with the oligarchs crushing people with militias and so forth, basically running the governments and the poor and into the ground at the same time, seems to have been the history that makes people wonder what's different about Francis.
Yeah, certainly it was not. Liberation theology is certainly a part of that whole picture. I think it's part of a much larger portrait. But you're right, Augie. It was not totally condemned under John Paul II, but certain aspects of it were. But Pope Francis, of course, comes from a whole different tradition. I think it's hard for people to kind of grasp that he is from Argentina. He's not a European. He speaks Italian very well, but he's not a European. He's a South American. And his experience of all of that is significantly different than any of his predecessors.
Well, the other thing is, on the liberation theology issue, I had a friend who I haven't been in contact for some while, who was a Marinol and who rode horseback all through Guatemala. I ended up having to leave the order. Retire, that is, because he suffered knee and leg pain and so forth to the extent that he couldn't continue. But he was pretty much of a conservative in the sense that any of the flags that went up that had a communist logo on it, of course, he said they are communists. And I said, well, aren't they really people seeking some relief from the crushing leadership that took their lands from them and so forth? His name was Bill also. And then you have the story that came out of what was the previous name for this pope when he was in Argentina?
Jorge Bergoglio.
And supposedly he actually was somewhat responsible for the hiding out of a particular priest who was charged with pedophilia and moved him to, I think, Peru or something, or helped him go to Peru or Chile, if I'm sure which country. Anyway, is that also part of the question marks?
Well, I'm not that familiar with that part of his history, but I...
It's topical.
Yeah, it is, and certainly that would be terrible if he did that. I honestly don't know that part of his early career.
Well, he ended up regretting having done that. As reason, and yeah. It came out in some early history on him, Broglio, when he went by that name as Archbishop. But his persona is so wonderful with people, and his shrewd handling of the Curia. And the way he's moved out of the Vatican, the place for a very questionable bunch of people having a state unto themselves, separate from the state of Italy, is an interesting set of things. He's got a very interesting friend who helps him, and that friend is out of Massachusetts. What's the cardinal's name?
Sean O'Malley.
O'Malley. It's my understanding that the O'Malley and others on the pedophilia issue have given the Pope a hard, in-your-face questions of what he's going to do about the pedophilia issue.
Well, and I think he came to the office of Pope with very specific agendas in mind, and we can't prove it because those conversations were confidential at the conclave, but my sense is that he was given very specific things that he was hoping to accomplish. He's an older man. He's the oldest pope that was ever elected, and yet now with the example of Pope Benedict being able to retire, I think he's got a very short time frame here, maybe 5 years, where within that 5 years he hopes to accomplish a number of things. And I think that's why he put that group of cardinals around him, led by or including Cardinal O'Malley, to advise him and to keep things on track, because he does rely on those men greatly. So he's a very self-effacing man, and he understands his own limitations, and he thrives on that sort of a group process, like group dynamic that he has with these people that he trusts, and they're keeping him on task, I think.
Bill, for a long time, the church had this history of accumulating power, wealth, and land. The idea of celibacy, so that the priests could not pass down their properties to their children. And suddenly, we have this pope with this concept of liberation theology. Do you want to describe what that means for our audience? What's happening here?
Well, liberation theology, of course, in the simplest form, is really saying that Christ, when he came to free. I mean, we see that in the gospel. You know, I've come to free those who are imprisoned, to feed the hungry, all of those kinds of things.
Feed the hungry.
And so the notion of liberation theology is that we in our own time must do the same thing that Christ did, which is to take that mission on, and therefore our mission is one of liberation. So that's the root of liberation theology, that in doing so we're following Christ.
And that's where Fox News Network has a hard time. You want to feed the hungry, you want to help the poor, and
without counting the cost. And again, that's something
without counting the cost. What does that
mean?
Yeah,
you don't help somebody because they can prove to you that they're worthy of that help. You help somebody because they're in need. And that's just the basic principle of Catholic social justice. I think for many of us, not only do I find it somewhat humorous, but I also take kind of offense at how they characterize this, as if somehow the right wing created social justice.
Well, there is a movement that the quiet majority, and all of a sudden this association of the far right with the church, and both the Baptist Church and the Catholic Church. And the idea was the concept of capitalism accumulating wealth, And that was part of what the history of the church was at one time. And Francis is just a radical departure from what has happened in the past. And I am so excited about this new pope. He's such a wonderful personality to add. And I'd love to get a chance to see him myself. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah, for those of us that are a bit older, and as I watch him and observe him, he's very much channeling another pope that we had in the 60s.
John the 23rd.
John the 23rd. I mean, you can see that he's almost, if I can use this expression, he's almost following John's playbook. You know, there's very much a very similar approach, and that's what he's trying to do. And,
well, John Paul I was a guy that was going to throw the buggers out and went a couple of weeks into his papacy and proceeded to announce Cardinal Cody and Archbishop Marchenko, who was responsible for the BCCS scandal, the stealing of the money, embezzling, and so forth. And they were going to be handed over to the Italian authorities at that time, in my recall, and that some people believe that was the sealing of his, that was the making of his doom, and then of course was going to continue on even more so with John the 23rd's open the windows and blow the buggers out that way, and the Curia and those people who were kind of creeped by all of that were lectured by Pope Francis some months ago over the way in which they did things and the willingness to be uncomfortable, making the afflicted comfortable instead of themselves.
Exactly, yeah. And again, what I think most of us are picking up from Francis is not only his demeanor as he does all this, but the fact that, you know, he's a 78-year-old man. He's got his own way of looking at things, and he's not going to let somebody else push him around. He just, this is who I am, this is who they've elected, and get on board.
Well, is he structuring anything since O'Malley and these people that are directly around him and not hanging out in the Vatican all the time and his somewhat dissociative relationship with the Curia? Is he doing something structural to make sure that the guy that follows him will follow in that mode instead of going in this backward mode that I think John Paul II did and Benedict also to some degree? Is he doing that to move the church in this more democratic fashion, or what is he doing, Bill?
Well, I think the biggest, he's doing some structural things there with the Curia, with the staff. Mm-hmm. I mean, but again, you could say anything there is going to be somewhat cosmetic, but he's putting those kinds of people in who will carry out these reforms, these structural reforms. But I think even more importantly is that he's opening up a number of the positions in those offices to a different type of person, to somebody who's going to carry out this kind of vision. But even more importantly are the kinds of bishops he's choosing. I mean, for example, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Blaise Supich would never have gone to Chicago as Archbishop.
Say that again.
Archbishop Blaise Supich, who is now the Archbishop of Chicago, would not have.
Why
been,
not?
Well, because of he's very much a moderate in many ways, but he's also a very humble man. He's very much like Francis himself. He's very concerned about the poor. He's very concerned about, as most of our bishops are, but he does it in a very concrete way.
Well, politically, you're touching on a city that has a huge murder rate and a great need to, especially in these times when people with cameras and so forth are seeing what the police do or don't do, and they have a history of false incarceration and false imprisonment in Chicago with a particular detective who was convicted of that and actually caused the suspension of the death sentence in Chicago. So you've got someone with this kind of mentality, and it's well known. I mean, back at the time of Mayor Daley, the city of Chicago, whenever there was a killing in a particular parish, that they would put 24 round-the-clock police there. It's to the extent that the city of Chicago had more police on the payroll than the city of New York because of that. So
yeah,
the power of the church in that city is very great, as it is in New York. And so, there you have a sitting cardinal who I have real questions about.
Oh, in New York?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've known Cardinal Dolan personally since we were teenagers, actually. So
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can see where people would take issue with things, but at the same time, I think essentially he's a good man and is trying to do.
I see him as strictly a politician. That's my perception.
Well, yeah. I mean, he comes off that way. He's kind of been that way since he was a very young man. I mean, he's very mm-hmm. very blustery and such, and you kind of have to look past the bluster.
Well, what I saw him doing is flipping and flopping to whichever side the wind was blowing, and that was my impression of him, but not, you know, on issues and so forth, and how to be sure you're on the right side or wrong side or left side or right side, whichever side suited him seemed like be the side he could glibly move to, but without going too much into Dolan, you mentioned Supich in Chicago, so uh-huh. in Supich's case in Chicago, what can he do about that poor city and what its plight is in social justice?
Well, I think, you know, he can do any number of things, but a lot of it will be how well does he, I mean, one of the things bishops do is that they provide and encourage pastoral leadership, both among laity and the kinds of priests that they ordain, the kinds of men that they bring into that kind of ministry, and that's where he will have a great effect. But also, how do you muster the social justice offices, Catholic Charities in Chicago, and those kind of things, and focus their efforts where they need to be focused. And that's the kind of thing he'll do, and he'll do it very effectively. Mm-hmm. He's not a big showy guy, he's in terms of personality, but he's a great guy at working, you know, one-on-one with people, with small groups. He'll be out in the streets. I mean, that's just kind of the way he is. He's a very, very good.
Yeah, because I've not even, I was, you know, usually I make mental notes or make notes that things like that are showing up, and certainly for the city of Chicago, I was unaware of him at all. So I'm pleased.
Well, that's probably been, in terms of the United States, that has probably been his most significant bishop appointment since Pope Francis became pope.
Really? And when did that occur?
He appointed Supich, I think, about a year ago.
So really,
a year and a half.
I didn't realize how in the dark I really was, but obviously I was. So Bill, you're going to go to the big event, and what date does the Pope show up?
Well, he leaves Rome for Cuba on Saturday the 19th,
mm-hmm.
and then he spends. Let's see, has the 19th, the 20th. And then on Monday the 21st, he finishes up there. Actually, Tuesday the 22nd, he finishes up in Cuba. So he's there several good long days.
Mm-hmm.
He arrives in Washington on Tuesday afternoon at Andrews Air Force Base. And then Wednesday, he will go to the White House. I think he meets briefly with the president. And then he goes to a meeting with all the bishops of the U.S. At the cathedral in Washington, St. Matthew's Cathedral. And then that afternoon he has mass over on the campus of Catholic University on Michigan Avenue. And during that mass he will canonize Junipero Serra. And then the next day is the day that's also going to be quite interesting, and that's where he heads over and addresses a joint session of Congress. And That's what I'm trying to get into, and if I could, that's going to be quite
well, you're going to have to call Pelosi or someone like that, right?
Bill,
well, actually, the local congressman here has been very generous at welcoming our group that's coming.
Uh-huh.
It's Congressman Sam Farr.
Uh-huh.
But actually, our bishop here is going to be able to be in the Senate chamber, the congressional chamber, for the speech.
Uh-huh.
I keep trying to tease the bishop that he really should let me have that ticket. But there's going to be jumbotrons all around. But that's the image I want to see. I want to see the Pope addressing a joint session and watching both Joe Biden on the one hand and John Boehner on the other behind him, both Catholics. And yet, because the Pope is going to, I guarantee you, is going to upset both sides of the aisle. And
Bill,
because
if I may.
He's not a Republican. He's not a Democrat. He's Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way to compartmentalize.
We've got to take a short break, but Bill, if I can, I apologize. We didn't get your last name, and could you give your last name, your name,
well, you know,
and
really
a little bit of your background?
I'm not here anonymously.
Bill from Monterey, Bill Dietwig, author, and so forth. And by the way, Bill, when we come back, I'd like you to just at least go over some of your writings and things like that, and some of the things you've done, a little more resume. We failed on that. We had some technical problems starting out this morning, so you have to forgive us a little bit.
They changed our buttons.
No,
they moved our cheese. Bill, how do you spell your last name?
It's
Dietwig, D-I-T-E-W-I-G.
Right.
Okay, so we've been speaking with Bill Dietwig today, discussing the Pope's visit and his impact on the church. We will be back in just a moment.
Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato, 4450 South Tamiami Trail. Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too.
With the animals, hunt, scream. With the animals, hunt, scream.
This part of the Morning Edge is brought to you by Callens, Little, and Delgado, practicing personal injury, criminal defense, and family law. Call 941-749-1446. 941-749-1446.
I may be crazy, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. Turn out the light.
And we are back with Bill Dietwig, discussing the Pope's near future visit and his impact on the church. Bill, welcome back to the Morning Edge.
And Bill, if you would get into your background a little bit, which we apologize for not doing, all the excuses being set aside.
That's okay.
But please.
Sure. I'm from Illinois originally, and attended the seminary. I studied for the priesthood for 8 years. When I left the seminary, got married and was going to be drafted, so I joined the Navy and spent a 22-year Navy career.
And you were a commander in the Navy, is that right?
I was, yes. Mm-hmm. But during that time, I also stayed very active in the church and in education. I have a PhD in theology from the Catholic University of America in Washington, where I spent a number of years. I worked on the national staff for the U.S. bishops for a number of years as well. I've been a professor of theology at a number of universities. I've lectured at Stanford. I currently teach at Santa Clara University. But I've worked in several dioceses around the country as well.
And, Bill, what do you think about women being deacons?
Well, I've actually written co-authored a book on the subject. It's interesting. Most people don't realize that while there's been pretty clear teachings, I guess, that you could say, that the Catholic Church cannot ordain women to the priesthood, that same question with regard to ordaining deacons has not been resolved. And so that remains an open question and might very well be something that...
You got in a little trouble over that at one time.
Well, there were a couple of our dioceses that no longer include me on their speakers list. Mm-hmm. But also, I've also been approached by those same dioceses saying that they were wrong, and they hope that I'll come in the future. So,
well, on that score, there's been some controversial bishops, notably one right down here in Venice, in the Venice Diocese, in near Sarasota and Manatee, in Bradenton, Florida, which is where this program emanates from. That's gotten into the same kind of censoring of people for being pro-life within the church or being part of organizations are. I founded an organization called the Southwest Coalition for Peace and Justice, which I no longer am the chair of. I wasn't until 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, whatever it was. I had an illness and it didn't allow me to do it, so I stepped aside, and now it's being taken over by a woman by the name of Alex Coe. And we're meeting tonight on some of these issues, but the Diocese of Venice literally censored our organization. We had three events in their cathedral, and when he became bishop, this particular bishop, whose name I'm not going to say right away, which I'll let you talk about, is a typical kind of reactionary conservative in power who then turns around and punishes people for having seemingly untoward attitudes towards their version of the Catholic Church or that bishop's version. What is that? What is that thing happening? And what? And you know, this thing is all over the country. So the Pope's got to be looking at that.
Well, he does, and it kind of goes back to what I was mentioning earlier. That one of the, you ask about how he can affect these changes in the long term, and I think that this is the key to it: is the types of bishops that he appoints. And so, you know, as selections are made for who's going to serve as bishop in a diocese, I will just simply say that the standards have been revised in terms of what he's looking for. Mm-hmm. In fact, there have even been some reference to Francis bishops, you know, bishops that kind of have the same point of view that he does towards social justice, towards the care of the poor, toward the care of the economies, very critical of economies if they make use of people and abuse people. It's a very different perspective. And so I think that's what we're beginning to see. I will say that there are certain bishops, and you are describing one of them, who I would say are in a very great minority of the bishops of the United States. I would say the majority of our bishops would disagree with the kind of actions that the bishop you describe has taken. So that's the good news. There are others like him, yes, but they are in the minority.
You have John Myers, who is in your hometown, Peoria, Illinois, who's in New Jersey, and he's being hit as one of the first ones to investigate in the pedophile thing. And made the news in the New York Times on that score. Isn't he the same guy that was building swimming pools and palatial circumstances for himself or for people around him? He came off at one time as a liberal, and then he became a conservative. I mean, the willingness to grab whatever flag is flying at the time seems to be what some of these guys do.
Well, and again, you and I have both known him for a long time, and that's quite accurate. Early on, as a young priest, he was known as quite a liberal guy. Obviously, that position changed. There's a considerable concern by many on his this retirement estate that's going on. And I'm sure his whole situation's being looked at. I mean, we have the example of the German or Austrian bishop that the Pope relieved. They called him the Bishop of Bling. I think that whole situation is being looked at. And I don't know, in Archbishop Meyer's case, given his age and all of that, I don't know how much will be done. I do know that it's significant that a coadjutor archbishop has been assigned there now for the last year or so.
So they have a coadjutor?
A coadjutor, yeah.
Well, okay.
Now, to explain to your listeners, a coadjutor is an assisting bishop who has the right of succession.
Oh.
So if Archbishop Myers decides this morning that he wants to retire, he can do that, and immediately this other man will become the Archbishop of Newark. Mm-hmm. There is no waiting for a new assignment or a new...
I thought a coadjutor actually had some other rights as well to act.
He does, but that's the principal one.
Oh, I see.
Any auxiliary bishop has the powers that you described. The, mm-hmm. the significant difference is that a coadjutor as the right of succession.
Oh, it becomes immediate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a hope. There's a hope for these guys that are. I mean, they do a lot of damage in the interim.
They do.
So I mean, I see these characters running around in this communities, regional community, Manatee, Sarasota. With the, I mean, the throwback of the long black robes and the collar, and I've listened to a few of them in restaurants and so forth, pontificating on the past in ways, you know, it reminds me people, the Old Testament being, you know, forget about the New Testament, the Old Testament is what we really care about, thou shalt not or else, testimonials, that kind of thing. Of the Sharia law. Now it's starting. Tom Friedman this morning on the Morning Joe, excuse me, on the Squawk Box, not ironically, but on CNBC, was saying basically that what I've been saying on this show for some time, that is Sharia law is being fed through ISIS and sponsored by Saudi Arabia, who also sponsored the 9/11 thing. And it was the only country that had candles burning in memory of the victims of 9/11 were the Iranians, the only country in the Middle East, the only one, not even Israel was doing that. So it's an interesting thing when you have these extreme characters within religions, Islam in the case of Saudi Arabia, and the extremes within the Baptist Church, within the Republican Party, and within the Catholic Church, and some of these characters.
Well, I think what we see, and I refer to this often, has been the sort of the evangelical Christianity is quite distinct from other say Catholicism, and unfortunately, I think over the last 20 years. We've seen a sort of a homogenization where people refer to Christianity, it's like one size fits all.
Yeah.
And there really isn't. There's significant differences between evangelical Christianity and, say, mainstream Protestantism and Catholicism. There's significant differences. For example, I mean, I going back to where we started with this, with social justice, I mean, for those of us who've been at this, there's nothing new about social justice in the Catholic Church. What the reason it strikes people as new is because the hard right, heavily influenced by evangelical forms of Christianity, have sort of appropriated that term in a negative way, and so all of a sudden it's this huge political category, which it has not been in the Catholic experience for the last 100-150 years.
Well, don't you think the evangelicals of South and Central America? And Mexico as well, have a lot of power, growing power, in that version of Christianity, and with the history of the oligarchs running the church, owning the church, and of course the classic film called The Mission being an example of how the great church of Spain really crushed the inhabitants of the Andes Mountains and their peoples when priests acted in terms of social justice toward those people. The mix of the oligarchs and the church is largely credited or blamed for what has gone on in Central and South America. So this Pope has to be aware of that particular situation.
Well, I think to me, one of the things that's always struck me is that people like black and white. They like decisions. I mean, you and I experienced this when we were much younger people. You know, people would say, well, you know, tell me if it's okay to do this or that. Is it okay if I go to this movie? Is it okay or is it wrong if I go to this? People like black and white answers. They don't want to be told, well, make up your own mind or live with the gray areas. And I think there are certain forms of Christianity that say this is right, this is wrong, period. No discussion, no gray area. But that's not really been the tradition within the broader spectrum of Christianity. And I think what Pope Francis is reminding people is that we live in the gray. You know, yes, there are certain things that are wrong to do. We get that. But living life is never black and white. There's always times where we live in the gray. And I think that's what evangelical forms of Christianity don't seem to be able to accept. And I think that that's what we're seeing here politically. It's much easier if you get a, you know, somebody like a Donald Trump who gets up and says something idiotic, and yet people say, yeah, but he speaks his mind. Well, so does my, you know, crazy
grandson.
Uncle so-and-so. That doesn't make him a president. You know, so I just think there's this acceptance or this realization that we live in a very gray world. And sometimes we make decisions that are right, and sometimes we make decisions that are wrong.
The Pope is interested in allowing people who've been divorced to get married again in the church. That's a radical new position.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in October. So much on this has got to be looked at and revised and all the rest of it. And I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to keep our eyes on in October.
Another gray area that he's willing to move into, to say that we've got to accept all these people into our church, not just the select few. And it's a remarkable change that's happened.
There's been so much confusion over what the Catholic Church has always taught, and most of us experience this in our own families. I mean, the Catholic Church has never said somebody who's divorced is cut off from the church. That's just one of the biggest mistakes that people make. But it's that divorce and then getting married again that is the real issue. And I think there's all kinds of ways that can be addressed.
Well, the annulment scandal that's run around, that the wealthy can buy off their divorce situation, get annulments, and marry again and again and again, and we see evidence of the celebrity annulments and things like that that have gone on, and the corruption that the church is pointed at. I mean, the corruption of the church at the top is when it becomes I think it has been personally obvious, my own experience, and I think one of the best examples of how they screwed up the redoing and the repairing and redigitalizing and messing up the paintings of Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel. It was just a horrendous mess. Berenson, at the time, the writer, author of many art criticisms, said it at the time. I said it when I witnessed it personally. Destroyed those paintings in the imagined idea that they knew better than the artist. And is this kind of condescending politics that goes into the arts, goes into the personal lives of people, all this sort of thing. And then you have the evangelicals coming along and saying, well, the real issue is Christ came out of the Ten Commandments, therefore that's what prevails, that's what's important, and we'll just ignore the commandment of love and forgiveness. I mean, I just think that's at somewhat at the heart of the whole thing.
Well, there's all of this that you're talking about is very true, but I think that's what Francis is modeling for us, and I think we saw it with other earlier popes, like we've mentioned John the 23rd, who lived a very simple lifestyle. He hated the pomp and all the rest of the stuff that was about that, but it was the attitude, it was the underlying perspective on the world. Mm-hmm. And the perspective on the world that we see from Francis, we saw from John the 23rd, is a very positive assessment of the world. The world is not something to be escaped from. It is a place to be lived. It's a gift from God. And there's a positive approach to creation and to the world and to our responsibility for those things. And I think that's the positiveness, if that's the word I want to use, that we see with Francis, that's impacting so many people in a positive way. That, wow, this... let me give you an example, if I can. The Pope is not a radical liberal theologian. I mean, that's not his approach. His approach is one of a good pastor. And shortly after he was elected, a friend of mine called... who is gay, and he said, "What do you think of this new pope?" And I said, "Well, I don't know much about him yet. We're all learning about him." And he said, "Well, I think there's chance for some real change here." And I said, "Well, you realize he's probably not going to stand up and change a lot of teachings about homosexuality. I mean, whatever that is, you know." And he says, "But he said that's okay." He said, "With this man, I feel like this is a man who truly cares for me. and can love me. He said, under previous regimes, he said, I never felt that I was loved. I don't care if somebody agrees with me. I just want to be I just want to be appreciated and respected and loved.
Back in 2007, you wrote a book called Servant Leaders in the Servant Church. And you were talking about this theme before Pope Francis. And again, this was kind of a different stretch. What was the basic message of servant leaders?
Well, the notion that, and again, I've always been intrigued by notions of leadership anywhere, but in particular, leadership in the church. And the notion that we are servant leaders, that are the best leaders ever, and I don't care what context you're speaking, are the leaders who care for the people they work with. So even in the military, the best leaders were the ones that took care of their troops first, that made sure they were fed and had a place to sleep and to rest and those kind of things. So it's that basic attitude that I'm talking about that we see with Francis. He's concerned with the other, and that's what a servant leader does. A servant leader says, I'm here to serve those I am leading. And that's the basic thrust of this. Now, that particular book that I wrote was about a part of the clergy known as deacons. I happen to be ordained a deacon. And so it's the word diakonos means servant. But yet there's this notion that I lead through service.
There are how many deacons in the country and how many priests?
Right now there are approximately 18,000 to 19,000 deacons in the United States, probably 45,000 worldwide. In the United States at this point, I think we have roughly 20 to 25,000 diocesan priests in the United States. So almost the equal number of priests and deacons.
Well, help me out. What's the difference between a priest and a deacon in the Catholic Church?
There are three groups of ordained ministers in the Catholic Church, and only three, in terms of people who are ordained. And so bishops are ordained, priests are ordained, and deacons are ordained. A deacon is ordained to be sort of the right hand of the bishop. That was the traditional role of the deacon. Ancient writing referred to the deacon as the eyes and the ears and the heart and the hands of the bishop. He used to extend the reach of the bishop. And so very often deacons will be assigned to a parish to work with priests, but other times deacons are in charge of other things. Like in my own case, I'm responsible for all of the faith formation that goes on in the Diocese of Monterey, for pastoral planning and those kind of things.
And you can have a wife?
Yes. We are about 94-95% of us are married and have families.
Less pedophilia among deacons than among priests?
God.
there have been a few tragic cases of that, but by no means a great number, no. And so, again, all of us who are deacons and who are married are responsible for providing for our own families. We typically do not get a salary. Now, I do because I hold a diocesan position. But the average deacon in a parish, for example, does not. So you find deacons, in a way, some of the earlier thought was, and Augie, you'll recognize this term, was based on sort of the worker priest movement in France.
Sure.
So we're out working in other jobs. We have teachers and farmers and lawyers and who are also deacons.
Bill, you may be. We may have a caller with a question. Is that do we have a caller, Floyd? Do we have a caller? We don't. Okay.
So okay.
I think so. They wanted to, but they changed their mind, I suppose. Anyway, the other question that comes to my mind, Father Sarah is going to be brought up for canonization. And the two popes were canonized recently, or a year or two ago, whatever it was. John Paul II and John the 23rd. I really have some question about that. The canonization of John the 23rd, I'm on board with. But it's just... do we have a caller? No, we don't? Okay. What are your thoughts on that in the role of canonization for that situation, Bill?
Well, I think trying to keep things in a bigger kind of a broader perspective. I happened to be in Rome for that mass, and in fact, I helped distribute communion during the mass. I think what was quite clear is that Pope Francis was to be a reconciler. He was trying to say these are two very different models of Pope, and the Church is big enough to encompass both of them. I think one of the mistakes that people often make, and it's an understandable one, is that somehow when we canonize somebody, when we say that they are now a saint, that somehow we're saying they were perfect. And that's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is that there are certain traits in the way this person lived their life that are worthy of imitation. And so he would have looked at John Paul II and said, yeah, he was not a perfect human being. None of us is. But there are certain things. I mean, his focus on evangelization, for example, the things he tried to do with his international travel, those types of things that he would point to. But also, by bracketing him with John the 23rd, he's saying, look how big our effort needs to be. That this is a big tent here that could include these two very diverse men, and this is what we're trying to do. And we're seeing that with Francis in a lot of areas. So I see it in that perspective.
So if you... How is the canonization decided anyway? I mean, because
it's typically a very long process. Uh-huh. And so that was one of the unusual features of John Paul II, was that it was not normally that long. Sometimes these things linger for centuries. For example, Junipero Serra is going to be canonized on September 23rd. The process began for him in 1940. And then it just kind of works its way through a process.
Well, what I mean, I guess my question goes to who decides it. I mean,
ultimately it's the Pope who makes that decision now. In the ancient
so
church.
So Benedict basically decided on John the 23rd and John Paul II. Is that correct?
No, Francis did.
Oh, Francis did. Oh, Francis. That's, of course, that's right. It was during his time. Sure.
Right.
Hmm.
So anyway, yes, but ultimately it's the Pope, and that's how that works.
Yeah, I was never a fan of John Paul II. I know a little of the history when he was in Poland and so forth, and the church was the salvage point for salvation point, it should be, not salvage point, maybe that is the better word, against communism at the time, and when communism fell, you know, people fled the church in great numbers, and that is the story in Poland. So his leadership largely somewhat in doubt because of that.
But again, I think what we're seeing, trying to understand this with the broader view from Francis, I think what was happening is that there are many people who agree with you on that, and what we were seeing was polarization. We're back to that black versus white again. And so you would see people who saw John Paul II as a big hero and would therefore criticize somebody like John the 23rd, and vice versa.
Well, that becomes a political argument, and if you were to look at the church...
You're listening to 1490 AM.
Hold on.
WWPR.
There's a station.
Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
We just hold on, Bill. Anyway,
sure.
We're able to... look at that as a political thing within the church, and I think it made people cynical to a large extent in the world. And you see this kind of thing making in fact, I said in 79 when John Paul II went to Mexico, the church is dead from the neck up. I'm sorry, folks. That was my opinion. I was a gathering of many Catholics, and they were shocked that I would say such a thing. I says, mark my word, you will see things that you will not believe. But anyway, I didn't mean
but
to...
See, I think, but you make a good point, Og, and my point is that I think that's what Francis is trying to overcome.
Well,
I think he's trying to say, yeah, don't pick sides.
Sure.
You know, it's not John the 23rd versus John Paul II, or vice versa. It's both of them.
Right.
And, you know, so I think that's what he was trying to signal with that particular canonization, by having them both at the same time.
Well, Bill, we're going to have to probably cut this off, but I would love to make this a two-hour show. Unfortunately, we only have the first hour, and again, like before, enjoyed this immensely. And let's talk if there's a chance. If there's a chance to talk about this down the road here shortly, before you head out, let's do that.
I'd love to hear afterwards. We've been speaking to Bill Dietwick. He's going to be meeting with the Pope, or at least seeing the Pope, in his visit to the United States. So, welcome. I hope to see you next Friday.
That's to our audience. Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.